Yeah, well, how did I come to be here? Well, that's a kind of interesting thing. I came to be here because I didn't have a good enough reason to know. And, you know, I was mindful of the fact if you ever want to remain humble, there are two ways of doing that. One is to get married, and the other is have grandchildren. My eight-year-old granddaughter was asking me, "Pa, why are you going away on the weekend?" I said, "Well, I have to go and talk to people." And she said, "But you're not famous." And I said, "Well, how do you know that?" And she said, "Well, because you're not on the internet." And I said, "Well, maybe we should have a look." And then she delivered the final coup. She said, "Just look under old people." And that's actually not made up. That's a true story. So I come to you with that background of being completely deflated before I'm even started. It was interesting to hear Joel talk about eye contact last night. I found that fascinating. And as Steve said, I do a bit of work in the prison system with a whole range of offenders. And one of the things I frequently say at the beginning of every session is, I can guarantee you one thing. If you do not make eye contact with me, I will certainly ask you a question. And then you spend the next sort of hour with people sort of staring at you to the stage where you think, I'm not sure, is there something on my face or whatever. But so there we are. I looked at the conference topic and I thought, wow, cultivating intentionally holy lives. And I thought, there is so much in that. Like having a background in horticulture for the larger part of my working life, I thought, you know, cultivating, growing, nurturing, there's a lot of work in that. It's actually a verb, it's a doing word, as I would have said in days gone by. And intentionally, being quite deliberate, being on purpose, growing the kind of life that finds favour with God. It involves a bit of work. And then, of course, a holy life, a life that is set apart. And I guess that's what I want to talk to you today about. I think sometimes that says, you know, when it comes to business, that business and ethics and the Christian life sort of are like at a crossroads, that you meet at a crossroads. Well, my view is very different to that. My view is that they are not dissolvable, that they need to be running together, hand in glove. At one stage, if I'd read that topic of the conference today, I would have called that a BHAG, which was a very topical acronym years ago, a big, hairy, audacious goal. And business was famous for setting these enormous goals, and they're working very hard to bring them. I actually wrote to the Romans in chapter 12, and you'll know this verse. He actually says, don't be, what? Conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And that's been a favourite text for me for many, many years. And I noticed the tense of that is that it's ongoing. It's only process. And many years ago, I read a J.B. Phillips translation of that, which, and I don't know, I am not a theologian. I'm certainly not an academic, and I don't know if this is theologically correct or not, J.B. Phillips' translation, but it actually spoke to me, and so I took it and I made it my own. He actually says, don't let the world around you squeeze you into its mould. See, that is a lifelong process, and I think what Joel was saying last night is the quest for holiness. We live in that state where the world is trying to squeeze us into a certain mould. And we are being called to holiness. I think the challenge is that, you know, and I want to say, you'll hear me say this two or three times probably today, maybe six times because I forget things a lot these days, that if you belong to Christ, you are bound to be different. You are bound to be different if you belong to Christ. And that translates into every single area of your life. And along life's journey, I've actually met people who've been doing their role for 25 years. And, you know, and I've often been mindful of the fact that maybe they have 25 years' experience, or maybe they just have 1 year repeated 25 times. The difference. And I apply that to myself in my Christian life. You know, I became a Christian when I was 19, which is a little while ago. And I want to think that I haven't just repeated the same experience every year. Robert Townsend was a guy who started Avis Rent-A-Car, and his big, hairy, audacious goal was to be the number one car rental company in the world. And not long after he started the company, he actually realised that a lot of his executives were spending an awful lot of time getting distracted. Now, stay with me on this. This is a long time ago. This is actually before this wonderful invention that we have called the mobile phone. And so he realised, because people were getting distracted, that he needed to actually cut that distraction off. And so he had a whole lot of Perspex covers to go over the desk phone. Do you remember desk phones? Some of you are too young to remember those. They had round dials on them like that. And then we got really smart ones with buttons on them that you could... And he had a Perspex cover made to go over the phone, and on that Perspex cover, he had written this: is what I am now doing or about to do moving me closer towards my goal? Is what I am now doing or about to do moving me closer towards my goal? And if the aim of our life is the pursuit of holiness through being intentional about that, it's a great question to ask. You know, as we, you know, and I found last night extremely challenging, to God's glory. And if I applied that question, is what I am now doing or about to do moving me closer towards a holy life? Well, if we are intentional, then we have to know what the objective is. And I had a friend that I grew up with. He was a bit older than me. He was a mentor. He was quite a funny guy. And when you talk about being intentional and having an objective, we used to spend a fair bit of time doing road trips. And he was famous for saying this. He used to say, "I haven't got a clue where we are, but we're making great time." And, you know, I think sometimes in our Christian life we can say that. I don't know where I am on the journey. I don't know if my life is a point starting from here and ending who knows where. But if I'm on this line, I don't know where I am, but gee, I'm making great time. You only make great time if you know what the end point is, can't you? Great time if you don't know what the end point is. I think that actually cultivating an intentionally Christian life workplace actually takes us into a place of constant tension. I don't know if you feel that. I feel that I live in a constant state of tension. Now, I'll make it easy for you. When I ask a question like that, that's sort of rhetorical, this means yes and this means no, okay? You just work with me on that. And when I say I live in a constant state of tension, because when you belong to Christ, you're bound to be different. And so that introduces a whole new parameter of options into your life. Is that Paul, when he wrote to the Colossians, said this. He said, in talking about Christ, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So no matter how great the tension appears in your life, rest assured that it is Christ who will hold things together. I actually think that an intentionally holy life is a full-time role. It's not something you can pick up. It's not an optional sort of thing. It's you're either in or you're not. If you belong to Christ, you're bound to be different, because it's who you are before it is what you do. It's what you do. And I think that's key. One example of that tension in my life in the world of work was a very clear challenge that I faced to either fully engage with all of the expectations of corporate life or consider other options. Can I tell you that one of the biggest lies that I've ever told in my life, which I've heard frequently from other people, but this is just about me, to justify the amount of time I spent at work, I used to say I'm just of truth in it. But the reality of the fact was that I was actually doing it because it satisfied my ever-increasing ego. I was going to really be honest, and if I was going to stand naked before God and confess, that because it satisfied my ego. One of the cutting points of that for me came in the area of corporate entertainment. I mean, there was a very real expectation in my life that we would entertain our clients into some fantastic functions. After going to some of these functions and going to corporate entertaining, can I tell you, we had no budget. It was what it had to be. And looking back, I feel moderately ill, immoral, but because they were wasteful. And so I actually reached a point in my life in discussing it with my wife where I actually said, you know, I actually think that enough has been too much. I was in a situation where I was robbing my family of time with them to spend my leisure time with people that I would rather not be in a lifeboat with. I went to my employer and said, you know, effective immediately, I'm actually going to go on to the reserve team, myself from the A team to the reserve team. Didn't go down too well because there was a very heavy expectation that we had these things. These didn't go well, but I can tell you this, I didn't regret that decision then, and neither do I regret it today. Talk to you for a moment about paradigms. Paradigms is a fascinating word, and I only found out what it was quite some years ago. When I was in grade two, I asked a question of my teacher. For those of you who are primary teachers here, take note. And my teacher said to me, I can't believe anybody would ask a question so stupid. And I don't think I asked another question till year 11. So when I heard the word paradigm, I went looking for it in the dictionary and couldn't find it. How is paradigm, is that even a word? All right? But I found out what it was, and I did some reading. I heard this guy talking about what paradigms were. And when I talk to the guys in prison about paradigms, that's always really interesting, because I say, this is the first honesty test. How many of you here have ever heard the word paradigm? Put your hand up, and if you don't put your hand up, I'm going to ask you to tell me what it is, and they all put their hand up like this. And that's okay. Paradigms are great because they teach us about our world, and they teach us where the box is that we live in, and they maybe can teach us a little bit about how to behave. It's our current view of reality. One of the things about paradigms is that they shift. They change. What time am I finishing? At midday? 12:30. Oh, 12:30. Okay. I just had a moment of panic. faster. And paradigms change in life. I don't know if you noticed that. When I was about 6 or 7, I had a paradigm that related to Christmas prep when I was 6 or 7, and we used to get these little up the motor and you'd let it go across the line over. And by the end of Christmas Day, they were broken. And you pick up the car and you turn it over, and underneath, stamped in the metal, were three words: made in Japan. And I had a paradigm that said Japanese stuff is junk. That was my paradigm. Fast forward to more recent times, and I've retired 3 times from work. I enjoy it so much, I keep on retiring. And one of the roles that I did was to run a car dealership. And one of the interesting aspects of running a cabin, do you know that service departments for Australian-made or assembled cars like Holden's and Ford's, what percentage of the total daily work through that workshop do you think is warranty work, fixing stuff that the manufacturer didn't quite get right? Okay, Holden's, Ford's, that sort of thing. Give me a number, a percentage. That means 80%. Some 80%? Nah, it's not that bad. Although some people have had cars that are 80%, yeah, like that. It's about 15%. So on any day, 15% of all the work coming through the workshop is fixing stuff that didn't quite get done at the factory. You go to a Japanese dealership like Toyota, what do you reckon the percentage is of warranty work through the workshop? So that actually tells you that the Japanese have learned how to make very, very well engineered but just slightly boring cars. When I tell that story to the guys in prison, it's really keen to me that owning a Toyota Camry is not an aspirational goal for any of them. So there's a paradigm shift. Talk about another paradigm shift, the taxi industry and Uber. Who would have thought? Who would have thought that they disrupt something that had been so established for so long? In 1968, there was a global shift in a paradigm, and I'll tell you, there was a global industry that had 65% of the global market and 80% of the global profits. For those of you who are not in business, let me tell you, 65% of market, 80% of profit, they're cranking good numbers, because that actually means your profit margin is sky high. Over the course of 5 or 6 years, their share of market fell to less than 10%. 50,000 people out of the 62,000 people involved in this industry lost their job. Now, that's what we call an impact. Does anybody know what the industry was? No? Good guess, though. Yeah? It was the Swiss watchmakers. Watchmakers had this little thing that we actually know what a watch is. It's really expensive. It's got little steel gears in it and wheels that turn, and we make an awful lot of money out of it, and we know watches. Well, it was actually the Swiss who discovered the quartz watch movement. But because their paradigm said, we know what a watch is, and that, my friend, is not a watch, they didn't bother patenting it. They took it to the World Trade Fair at Geneva, and there was a tiny, tiny Japanese company who actually went to the World Trade Fair and said, wow, we have a paradigm that says watches should be affordable and they should be functional and everybody should have two or three of them, and the rest is history. What happens when your paradigm becomes so rigid that you can't think outside? I had a paradigm that actually said, if I could only get people to the right skill level in business, I would enjoy success. Skill equals success. Well, after a particularly stressful time at work, I sat down with a friend of mine who I trusted implicitly, and most days of my life, I am dealing with the same problems. He looked at me, you know, with that pitying look that you have for people who are not... He said, Lindsay, let me ask you a question in return. All of the problems that you deal with in your daily life and work, how many of those problems relate to a lack of skill? As I reflected on all of those things that I'd been wrestling with, all of those things that kept me lying awake at 4 a.m. in the morning thinking, how on earth am I... It occurred to me that the vast majority of those issues had to do with either a lack of good character or a lack of understanding character that drives success. On the basis of that, we began a program at work called Character First, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later on. You know, I think as Christians, sometimes we are so involved in our world, we actually forget that we are living in a post-Christian era. And the words we use, some of the expressions, some of the things that we take for granted in our Christian life are like a foreign language to people. I remember reading a survey result of a whole group of kids in grade 4, and I think the figure was 84%. When they were asked the question, what's wrong with stealing, 84% said, given an age where many of the concepts that we discover so that we discuss so often in church is actually unrecognisable. People today, truth is what I say it is, and it depends on how I feel. I can't get over this. In our lexicon, the Macquarie Dictionary, which talks about common speak, phrase in the Macquarie Dictionary called non-core promise. Think about non-core promise. And I gather to mean that means that this is a promise that becomes a casualty. Very different to the other promises that you can trust. Maybe. One politician's wife said, You talk about a whole lot of things when you're trying to convince people to do things. But you don't, unless you have made a firm commitment about it. And he wasn't really into making firm commitments. Well, there's nothing new under the sun, because in Judges we read, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone's come full round, hasn't it? Okay, so how then do you develop good character? And I want you to see with me for a moment just a picture of Jesus holding grace and truth. It'll be important as I talk a bit more in a moment. Frequently I find myself asking the question of myself, this situation that I'm now involved in, is this an opportunity for grace or is this an opportunity for truth? Or maybe it's an opportunity for both. We started character first on the basis that if people don't have an understanding of something, you've got to teach them. I didn't see any difference between teaching people what good character looks like than I did teaching them. Maybe because I'm fairly simplistic. So each month we focused on a new character quality. And because I'm essentially lazy, I went with the program, which listed 49 character qualities. And I've had all sorts of arguments and discussions with people and say, well, there's not 49, there's 52, there's 47, there's 16, there's... whatever you want. But we actually started with 49 character qualities. So each month, every employee of our staff, and there were 1,200 of them, would be recognised by their line manager for the exercise of one of those character qualities. I've got to tell you, just as a side note, when we first started, we learned a whole lot of stuff about our business that we never knew, but maybe we suspected. I had things like managers ring me up and say, well, you know, Lindsay, next month I've got to recognise Steve, and I've got the list of 49 character qualities, and I've been through it 12 times. Okay, so what you're telling me is you've got somebody working for you who is without any redeeming quality whatsoever. No, I'm not saying that. I just think we probably need a few more on the list. Oh, and by the way, I hate him. Had that conversation? Any Steve that was. Not that Steve. And you know, that told me volumes about our business. And a wise man said to me many, many years ago that people don't care how much you know till they know how much. Don't care how much you know till they know. And those managers in our business that had the best relationships when they recognised people for that character quality were the ones who just went through the motions, not so good. Change of topic, but sort of still on the same thing. I read a story many years ago. The American equivalent of Panadol is a product called Tylenol. And some years ago, they had a bribery. It was more than a scare. Three people actually died. Somebody was actually poisoning the tablets. And I don't know if you know that, but now you buy a packet of Panadol, you actually almost need a degree in astrophysics to open the packet, because they actually improve their packaging. Well, the guy, the CEO of the company, actually gave the order that all tablets were to be recalled to the factory and to be incinerated. And we are talking hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of product. And at the compulsory press conference, one of the reporters actually said to this guy, man, that is a huge decision. You have actually destroyed millions and millions of dollars of shareholder value in that company. How could you make a decision of that magnitude so quickly? I don't think this guy was a Christian, but his answer, I think, is something we all need to take on board, and I certainly have. He answered that question by saying, it's always easier to make a decision when you know ahead of time what you believe in. Always easier to make a decision when you know ahead of time what you believe in. I don't know what it's like for you, but I've never actually received a note in the mail telling me that something is going to come that's going to shake me to the core and I'm going to have to make a judgment call. Suddenly you find yourself in this situation where you need to make a decision. There's no warning. There's no time to prepare. And everyone from my world of work, a physical threat of violence towards one of our people from a major supplier. Didn't need to think. Deal with money and tax reckon I have heard every rationalisation that has ever been invented. Harry Packer's statement to the Senate inquiry, I don't know anybody that doesn't minimise their tax. Of course I'm minimising my tax. If anybody in this country doesn't minimise their tax, they want their head read. Away from that too, we work too hard and too long to pay excessive taxation. So what are the waters that you do not want to know about? He came to me one day and he said, Lindsay, can I see you for a minute? I said, well, you are. We've got an opportunity to make some serious money, because now there's two people. What happened is that he had been brokering a transaction between a grower and a buyer in another state. There'd been confusion over the price. The grower thought he was going to be paid X. The buyer thought he was going to be paid Y. And we, instead of working on a fixed margin in the middle, was happy with his price. Buyer's happy with his price. Very wealthy, very successful business associate rang me one day and he said, can I run something by? Other good conversations I've had with people have been, Steve, you and I have a problem. And then to a supermarket chain, and I won't tell you the product, so it could be one of 748. One of the things the major supermarket chains do these days is that they say, well, you're the supplier, it's your job to monitor the stock and to make sure that we never run out of stock. Okay? He had access to their data, their sales data. And he said to me, I've actually worked out, I'm supplying them with 16 lines. On two of the lines, their computer actually says they're throwing out more than they're buying. Now, we know that's not possible, but it just means the wastage or the shrinkage on those two lines. What I found amazing about that was that 12 months prior to that, he had been in his bed in a fetal position with the worst of depression because of a business trip in Brisbane, and us from every state in Australia there, we'd gone out for tea, sitting on the banks of the Brisbane River, and having a lovely meal, a restaurant owned by one of the guys. And one of the other guys says, well, where are we going after here? And, well, I didn't particularly go out. I've just spent all day with you guys. I think I've probably overdone. And one of them said, there's a nightclub just down here and they're running a lace and leather night. Now, to how naive I am, I thought, what night? Well, you can think about that for a moment. But I sort of worked out enough that I knew I didn't want to be there. And so all the other guys, you know what happens when guys get together? They just have a mess. Yeah, fantastic. And one of them turned to me and said, you up for it? I said, no, mate, I'm going home. What I found interesting, and I'll tell you that story incidentally, not to tell you how pious I am or how good I am, but within the short space of about 3 minutes, four of the other guys had said to me, do you mind if we share a taxi? The encouragement to me that I want to share with you is, when you get to that point where you have to make a decision about doing something, and it's hard, especially in those peer-based areas, when you make that decision, most of the time, others will breathe a sigh of relief. And no such thing as business ethics. It's just the right thing. What would people say at your funeral? A little? You know, I used to play this exercise with the guys that worked with the senior management team. I used to call it either the eulogy or the hill to die on. What is the hill that you are prepared to die on? What is it that people are going to say about you at your eulogy? Are they, this is a question, Tom, are they going to talk about your achievements? Or are they going to talk about your character? Maintaining eye contact, that's fantastic. I don't know who to choose.
I was going to say, we know what we would do, but we also know what the rest of the world...
Character's really, it's like toothpaste, I often think. You see a person's true character when they're squeezed. It comes out when you get squeezed. We had a guy, we were doing a major computer shutdown, turn up, turn on, programs and so on and so forth. Months and months and months of work had gone into this. The guy who was leading it, very ambitious, very driven, had managed to get all the guys on site. They're going to work 24 hours to turn off one system, turn on the other bit by bit. But apparently it was a very big deal. And halfway through the process, it all went south. Now just imagine this, you've got 128 semi-trailers out in the yard waiting to load with produce to go out to supermarkets in Victoria and New South Wales, right? Visibility about what's in that truck and what store it's going to. I actually lost it. He lost it. He turned on his team, he abused them vilely and just completely lost it. And can I tell you, he never recovered from that. Able to get back to that point where he'd been because people had seen an aspect of his character that they'd never actually seen before. Think about character being squeezed. Think about Simon Peter in the courtyard. And all of those people whose character was squeezed. And on the other hand, those whose refusal to compromise their faith actually put them into a far darker place. Think about it. I've spoken to a lot of companies about character first. When we started doing it, a lot of other companies came and started talking to us. And so I'd go and talk to them. And you know, quite often I'd noticed that a lot of the senior executives who came and spoke to me, they were a bit like the rich young ruler. They went away sorrowful. And why did they go away? To make sure their lives actually aligned with what they were saying. Once you actually run that flag up to the top of the pole and you say, we are a character first, the eyes of the world are upon you. Most of the time it was the business leaders that... I noticed something really strange after I spoke to many, many companies and city councils about character first. There was this repeated theme to our conversation. They loved the thought about teaching people about determination, about responsibility. They loved the concept of engaging with people about the topic of punctuality. They loved all that. But quite often as we got to the end of our meeting and they had their little card in front of them with the 49 character qualities on them, there'd be this slightly awkward pause of the throat. And they'd say, I also noticed the same thing in our own business. When it was come time each month to focus on a particular character quality, these three character qualities always provoked a response. Sometimes incredibly refreshing, sometimes quite vehement in the opposition to it, but they always provoked a response. And I'm going to tell you what the three character qualities are with the definitions, and I'm tipping that you'll actually get there before I did, because I was a little slow. The first character quality was meekness. Meekness in the Australian workplace that we actually applied, and so everyone knew what we were talking about. When I said meekness to somebody whose name was Steve, he knew that I was talking about this, and if he used that to move it, yielding my personal rights and expectations with a desire to serve. Obedience. Oh yeah, think about it. Quickly and cheerfully carrying out the direction of those who are responsible for me. And the third one, forgiveness. Clearing the record of those who have wronged me and not holding a judge, not holding a grudge. You know, obedience was quickly and cheerfully carrying out the direction of those who are responsible for me. I can give you these after if you like, Bruce. It's fine. I was really interested. I used to get for some time the journal from Harvard Business College, and I was really fascinated to see that one of their regular contributors, who was an academic, had come up with this new concept of leadership that was going to revolutionise the way business was done. And he'd come up with this name for it, and people were just in awe of this new thing called servant leadership. Why did those three cause such a stir? Well, I think if you think about it, they are certainly countercultural. in our culture, it is not seen to be highly desirable to be meek. Neither is obedience really a thing. Those of you with children will understand that. And forgiveness, well, you know, that's particularly in the world of work, it's not seen as being really desirable to be meek. I mean, who's actually signing up for the role of doormat? That's what meekness. And when I used to discuss that with them, I used to actually say, you know what? If you're having trouble with that concept, if you think meekness is weakness, try being meek for a week. See how you go. And get a picture in your head about the horse which actually has the bit in its mouth and refuses to spit the bit out. It needs that to control it. And meekness is really very, very tough. I have a problem with obedience. I don't know whether that's because of our convict heritage. I think it's more likely to do with our innate nature. This thing called she says, you know what, I actually think I do belong. We used to have this thing. When we took over a new business, the first thing we do is paint out the names in the car park. You know, observation was, from my, let him know that he wasn't that good. As for forgiveness, well, there's a whole new opportunity for growth. You know, this is a true story. I had a lady said to me one day, I would never, ever practice forgiveness or seek forgiveness in the workplace because that would mean I'd made a mistake. But of all the character qualities that we ever focused on at work, it was forgiveness that provoked the most discussion. Really interesting. And you know why I think those three character qualities are so divisive? I actually sat down and I thought about these character qualities and why I had so much resistance to it. What's the answer that I came up with? Paul, writing to the Philippians in chapter 2, verse 5-9, actually talks about the nature and character of Christ. And I'll just read that. Being Christ, who being in the very nature of God, did not count equality with God, grasped at or used to his own advantage. Yes. Even for forgiveness, you remember that terrific story in the Gospel of John. For all money, a trap is set for Jesus. Words that provide the sweetest music to all of us. I wanted to choose three character qualities that I wanted to see intentionally take in my life. They'd be the three. Other three that I'm working on. They are the three which have the ability, the potential, has prepared for me. Because meekness, forgiveness and obedience, that's not the world. Most days since I've been a Christian, I've actually prayed a prayer at the start of every day. Lord, as I go through this day, help people not to see me, but to see you. That's the only way I can make any sense. So meet fairly regularly with a friend I was at uni with. He was a full-time minister in the church, and we used to have this bit of a thing going. I would try to dislodge him from his pious perch, and he with equal vigour would attempt to drag me up from out of the messy pig pen in which I... Quite often we would actually bring our requests to God. One of these meetings he said to me, you know what, Lindsay, you should be in the midst for a moment. I said, you, I am in the ministry. I am in the ministry. It's just that mine looks different to yours. Every now and again, I got the opportunity to work in fresh produce. I'll tell you about a couple of things that happened in the space of a month, which comes and knocks on the door, and he says, can I see you for a minute? And I said, sure. Sat down. Big guy, Ruckman for one of the local footy teams, bursts into tears. And I said, what on earth is that? Guy comes in one day. This must have been the month. Tells me that his world is shattered. He's actually discovered that one of his young lady comes in and tells me she can't sleep. Place to listen without judgment. Being apart is the cost that we all pay. Being you may be uncomfortable to be around is and truth. In a moment of lunacy several years ago, I bought a sailboat. And held it down the coast. It's exactly 1,000 nautical miles. My wife, I'll see you in 10 days. I thought I'd do 100 miles a day. 5 and a half weeks later, I stepped off the boat, 11 and a half kilos lighter, because I vomited every day. It probably wasn't my best decision. But I learned something. I learned that when you're coming into a harbour at night time, if you don't have electronic navigation on your boat, which you don't, I had paper charts, and the paper charts actually tell you what the layout of every harbour is. And they have lead lights. And there's a back light, which sits high, and there's a front light, which sits low. I didn't get into that harbour, because there are sandbars, shifting sands each side of the mouth of the river, is to make sure those two lights align. If you start to actually drift and you see one light at the back coming out or the front one moving to the left or right, I actually think that just like in life, the best way for us to enter unknown heart of God and the Spirit of God. My office wall, I'm going to nail this. On my office wall, I had a quote written for many years, which people used to come read, and some people would comment, and some people would ask questions. Some people would say nothing one day in a book, and I thought, you know what? If I reach the end of my days, I must end machines, stocks, and bonds. There is fame of any lasting benefit. I will consider my earthly existence to have been wasting family.
David Belbin was telling me that as I was walking in. He said
it was really challenging. It made me think, all can I call it going down the rabbit hole? Like half an hour later, you think, how did I get this
right? Yeah,
you know, the crazy kids are sending me messages of.
I think that thing that we're not born that way. We're born as sinners.
Yeah.
And the thing is, that's not an excuse at all. And it's a reality.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to have that.